Howdy, folks. This is Revel Keats Ross, and you are listening to Prag Magic. I know it's been a little while since the last podcast, but been quite busy. Those of you that subscribe to the Patreon at patreon.com/pragmagic know that we just had a crazy month of launching our Somatic Magics, our handcrafted, handmade zines, and my personal talismanic workings through the cassette medium. These are all handcrafted and personalized. If you want to learn more, please subscribe to patreon.com/pragmagic, where you can also find tiers to receive a brand new hex cassette from either Hauntomancer or some Audiomancy workings that I've done, or maybe even the last Dim Zoom album or the new Revel Roz record that I've been working on in cassette form every 2 months. It's been a blast. Everyone from Sweden to Scotland to the good old US of A had received their packages. Granted, I think they received them right around November 5th. And well, we all know what happened that fateful day here in America. But without further ado, I just wanted to say how grateful I am to have had good friend, troubadour, and brilliant writer Gabriel Hart on for this episode. It was a really poignant episode and a prescient one. One of the time, one that I needed personally, because Gabriel had just finished his new book, On High at Red Tide. It's his debut novel. And we talk about the process of churning and chewing through a major work that has taken him years, about the accessibility of the past after some wisdom and after some exorcisms of working through your own personal lore and your own personal kind of narrative. And we talk about ex-hexing the self-imposed writer dilemmas, such as deadlines and letting the art speak for itself, trying not to rush anything. And well, he's done incredible work. You should check out Beyond the Last Estate. It's his new rag, his literary rag. It's incredible. You can find all of his links in the show notes below. I personally am off on a sabbatical. It's been a heavy month, and with some heavy innards a-brewing, both mentally, physically, emotionally, and I'm taking the next few weeks to recalibrate and focus in on my own projects that need some deep focus lensing, such as the Revel Roz record, the Haunt Manual print book, a new Divergent Magic grimoire. I mean, there's so many things, and I really want to take the time to calibrate and focus. So you can still be privy to all my goings-on at patreon.com/pragmagic or wethehallowed.org. I probably won't be posting on social media too much, but I have been really adamant about keeping the patrons up to date on all the goings-ons. So without further ado, please check out this wonderful chat I had with Mr. Gabriel Hart. Check out his book, On High at Red Tide, and for the love of all that is holy, haunt on. You've been on Prag Magic a couple of times, but the last time we chatted officially in this capacity was like 5, maybe 6 years ago, I want to say.
Yeah, was it 2019?
Yeah, oh, okay, yeah, 2019, yeah.
I think it was like, yeah, you always kind of catch me in like really interesting like moments. Like I think it was like, I was on there in like 2018, and then after my first book came out in like 2019, so yeah.
Yeah. And, I mean, since then, There's just so much to talk about. We're not going to cover all of the, you know, the major, we'll cover the major things in the past few years, but this year seems to be like a pretty bountiful kind of comeuppance for you with publishing your debut novel. Even though, you know, as I have right here, Virgins in Reverse, the twin novels, which I loved. We talked about it, Virgins in Reverse and The Intrusion. Mary and I were just talking about A Return to Spring, which I also really loved. And then here we are, On High at Red Tide. And there's something like synchronistic about the setting of the time. And I think our we share, because I went to high school, and what I seem is like a kind of fever dream version of the setting of this novel, in a way where reading it, I knew a Mikey, I knew a Tristan, you know, I knew these characters. I know they're not probably the same, but there's something very like, you know, analogous to the people in our lives during that, during kind of 20 years ago, kind of a.
Yeah, no, every town. You're right. Every town has a punk house, and it's and mm-hmm. I think it's I think when you tour a lot, you see, you know, there's something kind of reassuring where you see, you know, every town has that punk house, every town has that Mikey and Tristan and stuff. It's you can't escape it. It's like, yeah.
Yeah, have you been kind of on, I noticed today you posted your group The Starvations. You were posting that you were going through kind of the archives. It seems like this kind of, how do I put it? This kind of resolve about the past and creating something new, you know, with it. And for your debut novel, I just thought it was kind of beautiful that it seems like a lot of the setting and, you know, the people that you probably kind of took to conspire this was kind of probably around that time you were in The Starvations.
It's interesting. I'd been working on this book for Jesus, probably 5 or 6 years, right before the pandemic, I started writing it. But yeah, I mean, that the whole book has had this journey, and which I can go on and on about, but this summer, Dave Clifford, who was actually in The Starvations, he was in Jail Weddings, he moved to Germany, and he's starting a record label, and he's reissuing all the Starvations catalog, and this all came up this year's, and yeah, it's and it is interesting that it's kind of coinciding with On High at Red Tide, because mm-hmm. yeah, a lot of the subject matter that were, you know, kind of covered in songs by The Starvations are kind of covered in this book. It's not a musical book, but it's sort of, right. But it's a really, I think it's a good companion piece. It was an unintentional companion piece for, I think, these reissues. I hadn't listened to a Starvations record in probably a decade. It's a very, I mean, part, a lot of that, a lot of that music, I just kind of, it's so much a part of me. I almost just don't ever need to hear it again. But I forced myself to listen to it, and like with the novel coming out, and it just brought back all these memories that I hadn't thought of since, you know, they happened. So it was a really almost kind of an overwhelming alignment, you know?
Yeah, I mean, that's what I mean. It seems like a kind of a benevolent comeuppance of kind of, you know, the generations that you've been through. And yeah, I just thought it was interesting that it coincides. I mean, not perfectly, obviously, nothing does, but, you know, with you announcing the Starvations kind of mining of that archival stuff. And it was just interesting to me as like, you know, a creator or somebody that's often pondering, how do I kind of assess and reinvigorate, you know, the past in some kind of beneficial or creative way, you know, but I might.
Yeah, I'm really grateful to Dave Clifford, because I don't think this would have happened without his urging. And I think a lot of the members were nostalgic about that time, but also it's like, I'm in my late 40s, and it's so, it's difficult to kind of go back to that time because it's
yeah.
I don't know how to say it without being dramatic, but yeah, it's just a lot. It's a lot to revisit, and a lot, it's more than just music. It's a lot of just like, just sort of, yeah, there's just kind of like, yeah, there's sort of like a darkness there that we've been trying to wiggle from for decades now. So it's weird, but I feel like, yeah, we have kind of like some armor. We've found the armor since then to be able to revisit it without getting too like emotional or whatever.
Yeah, it's kind of gifted now with the, you know, the wisdom through it. But I wanted to talk about On High at Red Tide specifically, like the genealogy. You said I knew you were working on something last time we, you know, chatted in depth about, you know, your past book, Virgins in Reverse and stuff, and you had mentioned, you know, there was something you were working on, but I didn't realize that it had kind of been this. It had been your first novel for that long. Like, what was the genealogy of it? Did you have a sort of conceit in a way of like of a story you knew you needed to flesh out and chip away?
I've been trying to tell this story since I was a teenager. I mean, and it's such a specific, it's a very specific story. And I feel like, yeah, I knew I was going to write this book for, you know, probably since before Virgins in Reverse.
Yeah.
There's a lot of, like you say, like reconciliation, I think, that needed to happen with that, you know, growing up in that punk house and everything and all the intensity from it. And, so I started writing it in earnest, like, yeah, right when the pandemic happened. I got injured during the pandemic, and I was kind of not bedridden, but I couldn't really move. I was just, yeah, I had to have surgery and all this stuff. So I was on disability, and I'm just like, I better write this book now, because I don't know when I'm ever going to get this time again, you know? So yeah. I just started jamming on it really, really hard. And I had done, around the time I moved out to the desert 10 years ago, I actually started interviewing a lot of people from my past. I thought the initial book I wanted to write was going to be like a really sprawling account of just like punk rock in Orange County. And I knew I wanted it to have like a noir angle, because I think Orange County is a really misunderstood place. You know, even the punk rock aspect of it, it's just way different when you grow up there. And there is a seedy underbelly to Orange County, and it's not how, you know, the rest of the world thinks of it. So I wanted to really write that version of it that I knew. So yeah, I felt like I had to interview all these people just to really get the whole, the landscape and just like bunch of experiences and filter everyone's experiences. And I realized once I started writing it, I'm all like, oh, that was kind of unnecessary. The story I started writing was really, really, really personal and really specific. And I think the plot that kind of came, it was something I was actually trying to bury, and it just came, the plot came screaming instead. And you know, when a plot comes screaming, you know you're supposed to write it. So I wrote this. It was like 400 pages. It was an insane amount of work. And this was like in 2021, I think, I decided, oh, I'm done with the manuscript. And I had, you know, I had done a bunch of edits on it, but I was still just like one guy. I didn't have an editor at the time. And I was spending a lot of time on Twitter, and I tweeted something really silly. Like, I just finished my 400 page totally unmarketable punk rock methamphetamine novel. and everyone started, you know, chiming in going like, oh, what are you going to do with it? Are you trying to find an agent? And I, replied back to this guy, and you know, in public, I tweeted back, "There's no way in hell any agent would have the guts to touch this thing. It's too, it's too gnarly." And right when I typed that, 30 seconds later, this agent slides into my DMs. This really big agent from the Trident Media Group in New York. And he said, "Send me that query immediately." I'm all like, what the fuck? This is insane. This is almost suspicious the way this is like unfolding.
Yeah.
And I sent him the query. I sent him the manuscript. And 2 weeks later, he calls me and he says, "Yeah, I'm so-and-so." I don't want to say his name just because, but yeah, "I'm so-and-so from Trident Media Group. And I want to represent you in your book." I'm just like, Jesus, this just sounds, I couldn't believe it. And we talked and he really believed in the book. And yeah, he took off and ran with it. And I, at the time, the working title was High Prey Drive, which I don't know if you know that term, but it's like the, it's the term for dogs when they have the urge to kill, you know, an animal with a high prey drive.
High prey. Okay.
And, yeah, and he wanted to change the title. That was the only thing he wanted to change. So we had this working title called the Devils of Blackout Beach.
And that's a pretty great title, I'm not gonna lie.
Yeah, and I thought I liked it. I mean, it was like kind of a back and forth with like a, you know, for like a month. And but yeah, I liked it. It sounded like a 60s exploitation film or something. And yeah, the novel does have some elements of that in it, I believe. So I mean, he took off and ran with it, and he, you know, he sent it to all the 23 of like the biggest publishers out there, and it was really fascinating, that whole process. And you know, the rejections started coming in, and he was sharing them all with me, all the feedback and everything. And this went on for about a year, and then he finally was all like, shit, man. Like, I, you know, everyone rejected this book. You know, I'm so sorry. I did all I could. I still want to work with you and everything. You know, I want to see what your next manuscript. And he's all, you're welcome to do whatever you want with this, with your manuscript at this point. And I read it. The blessing and the curse of being a writer is you don't know how much you're improving until it's too late sometimes. Mm-hmm. And I hadn't looked at this manuscript for about a year, and I read it back, and it was a fucking pile of garbage. Like, straight up, like, I couldn't believe what I was reading. I mean, it had all the best intentions. And I think even the agent even got too excited about it. Like, he saw the grand concept, but not the prose, you know,
the minutia. Yeah.
Yeah. And I just couldn't believe what I was reading. And it was like, oh my God. And I was really prolific at the time. I mean, I was subbing, I was having really good luck, like with acceptances and submissions and everything. I was very, yeah, my work was really getting out there in that whole year he was shopping it around. So I was mortified. And so I just really just kind of buckled down and just started rewriting it. And the more I started, and I was relieved, and it was strange because the whole time this agent had it, I was just panicking. Like, it was exciting, but I was stressed. Like, it just seemed, the way it happened, it seemed like something was missing, like some step or something. It just seemed too, and basically what I realize is that I think this guy plucked me too early. He plucked me and the manuscript too early, before it had fully developed. So
like a treatment or an excerpt or something, or did he just go full?
He read the whole thing, you know, and I think,
wow,
he never assigned me an editor or anything like that. It's still, you know, so I think he was trying to, yeah, just sell the concept, you know, and then we would edit it from there. But yeah, and this guy was like, this guy had done like all this crazy stuff. He did like the the Black Dahlia Avenger and stuff. I mean, he really knew his shit. So my point is, when I was relieved to get it back, because once I knew it wasn't made for that world, that Big Five publishing world, it gave me the opportunity to like get really weird with it. And nice. Really, really like find out who these characters were and just like be really like unselfconscious. Cause I think even like the version I gave him, I think had this sheen on it, this kind of commercial sheen that it wasn't me, you know what I mean? Yeah. So I spent about a year just getting really weird with the book and really, really like immersing myself in each of these characters. And I ended up working with, I don't know if you know who Elle Nash is. She's a really amazing writer and editor. And I worked with her. She like helped, she did some developmental edits with me. And then I started shopping it around to independent publishers. And then it landed at Pig Roast, and it was like the best place for this book. I mean, he's Jeff and Ruby like really understand, I think, the punk rock thing and
what type
of book it was and what it was supposed to be. And it was just the best home for it. And then they assigned me Lisa Carver to do the final edits. And that was just a total thrill to work with her. I really looked up to her growing up. So they put out her books and stuff. So it was just a really, really fortuitous the way it all came together. Like, It felt very lost at sea, and then it found the perfect island.
Yeah, what's amazing too is that it's not only something spinning in you for so long, but what's a like draft was it that first treatment, like because like what I'm interested in this is that entire processes of like chipping away, working with another editor, helping you, what I mean? I love that like it kind of, it came out, was that more of like that first treatment that the agent got, or that first draft, was that more of a you just unadulterated, and then from there?
Yeah, but it wasn't a good unadulterated. It was like, right. it was, I didn't have any perspective. I mean, it was so, it was like that, I think that flagrant tweet, it was the fault of just being compulsive with like tweeting about something that you finished and it wasn't even finished. And the next thing you know, this like big agent has his hands on it. I mean, it was like, yeah, it was silly. It was a huge, huge lesson, the cautionary tale of like being too impatient with something, Yeah. A lot of writers have that problem too. They like think, yeah, they think they just have to go and produce and it's, but you the best books I think take years to develop. And yeah, that was a fatal mistake on my part. But I'm glad I had that experience, because it just taught me a really valuable lesson.
No, absolutely. I mean, it's worth it. Reading it, there's a rhythm to it that's just unmistakable. I would never have thought that it has a flow to it. Like it has like a linear kind of, rhythmic vernacular. It doesn't seem like at all like it's, deeply edited. There's almost like a gust to it, this kind of like strength. And I wouldn't say deeply edited, but you know what I mean? I would have thought that it was a very prescient kind of writing that you were doing. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
No, I would say, I mean, I think what term did you use? It's like the wind or something.
Prescient. Oh yeah. A gust. Yeah.
It probably reads like the gust because it is very heavily edited. I mean, that's like, you're not probably getting hung up on, the gust isn't getting hung up on tree branches. It's like going
right.
Yeah. No, I mean, I would say it's a very heavily, the best edited books are the ones that don't feel like they're edited.
Right. For sure.
That makes sense.
That's what I was getting to in my long roundabout way, but no, it's an absolute like achievement. And as something, as major as someone's debut novel? Like, how are you feeling? Is there like a kind of reprieve at all? Is it just kind of down the hatch? When's the next one? Like, how are you?
The week before the release date, I had a really, people kept asking me like, oh, are you excited about your book? And people just kept asking me that. I was getting so annoyed. I'm all like, no, I'm not. That's not like, I wrote this so I would stop being excited. Like, excitement to me is like anxiety, you know? And I think I write to rid myself of that. I wanted to find, you know, calm, you know? But it was weird that there was all this anticipation of it coming out for me. And then I like forgot it was coming out. And then the weekend before, I'm just like, oh shit, my book is coming out next week. And I was just like, suddenly I just got, it just felt really like, I started panicking in a really profound way. Where I kind of had this like 3-day panic attack. Not that I was like worried about what people would think about it or anything, but I think I had lived in the book for so long, and the subject matter was so much a part of me that it all of a sudden felt like this like sacrificial thing that was about to happen. It felt crazy. Like,
yeah,
I almost didn't want it. I didn't want to let go of it. And I think
there was
crazy panic in me that I didn't want anyone to have it. I was confident about it, but I didn't want to let it go. It was a really dark week leading up to the release date, I like talked to some close friends, I think, that would understand this kind of thing. And I, by the time the release date came, I had mellowed out. But yeah, it was a really like psychically, tough week. But I think that has to do with the kind of book it is and how, close the subject matter is to me and stuff. But it wasn't, it didn't feel like a celebration. It felt like the end of something.
Sort of wake almost.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Cause I think about that all the time. I've got that kind of white whale of a project that I've been tending to for years and years. And I was thinking to myself the other day, like, it's probably never going to come out because I need it to not come out. You know what I mean? Like, I need something so to go strange. Back to.
It becomes like this visceral, like physical part of you. And it feels like this massive, like scary surgery is about to happen. It really feels like sacrificial. That's like the best way I can describe it. But we keep doing it. And it's interesting that we just keep doing this to ourselves. And like, it's so stupid too. It's like that we're choosing to be in anguish about our like creative process. It's like, we should be so lucky, you know? But I think when you're like kind of bedeviled by your work, I think it's going to have that effect on you, you know?
Yeah, so let's talk about like maybe the kind of overarching ritual of working on it. Were you intentionally kind of spacing out or ritualizing time to work on it, or was it something that you kind of just retreated to amongst the other projects you were doing that were more like immediate, say like, you know, whether it's Jail Weddings or say it's, you know, The Last Estate, you know, magazine, like all these projects that you had, was that what you kind of went to, you know, on top of all the things that were happening? Did you formulate a day? Yeah.
I would say it was my main priority. I mean, it was like the time riding on it was like almost this vacuum of time that just like ceased to exist. I mean, I can't, part of me can't even remember working on it. And it, you know, the best work that was done on it was the work that was done when I got the manuscript back from my agent. And that was like that. I'm like nostalgic for that time of it because I had the time to just get as weird as I wanted with it. And I started, you know, I actually, you want to talk about ritual.
Yeah.
You know, I grew up in the whole transcendental meditation cult. I don't know if we talked about that before.
I just did. But I started one of those today.
You do TM?
I would say like a kind of
a form of it.
Anarchic version of it. Yeah. Yeah. Not an official capacity, but yeah.
I started to really lean, and I have very, you know, I grew up in that cult, mm-hmm. and it is a cult. Don't let anyone tell you that it's not. And I was really embittered by it, but I still do it because I think meditation is really cool and beneficial. But when I was really trying to immerse myself in these characters again, I really leaned into meditation again, and I would visit these characters in my head and really hang out with them, and they just, it started just becoming so real in that deep kind of subconscious abyss, and I was just spending a lot of time with these characters, and I started becoming, basically what happened, I thought, you know, the first version of the book was so autobiographical, because I, you know, everyone thinks that they've had the most unique life, and you know, but when you take so much from real life, it ends up not reading well at all. It ends up, you can't let go. You lack perspective of what's actually important and what's readable. You know, and I think that's what happened with that first draft. And so I basically looked for, I Frankensteined a lot of, so one thing that when Elle was doing the developmental edits with me, she's all like, you realize that there's 26 characters in this book. And I didn't realize that at the time. And so I began kind of Frankensteining these characters together. I cut it in half. I got it down to 12 characters, and I was looking more for like archetypes rather than people that I knew. I wanted the reader, even if they didn't grow up in that kind of debauchery, I wanted them to at least recognize feelings rather than characters. And so these characters kind of embody these kind of universal feelings, I guess. But yeah, so to speak to ritual, this meditation, and you know, they say you're not supposed to act on any creative ideas you have when you meditate because it's going to be too abstract or whatever, but I really leaned into that. I developed these really intimate relationships with these characters, for better or worse.
Yeah, in that kind of imaginarium way. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I see. I totally get that. I love this idea of kind of the amalgamation of characters and kind of combining them for archetypal stuff. I think of like, you know, the suits in the tarot or whatever, like the, you know, even the Myers-Briggs personality types I've used before as like a way to kind of objectively get to know a character fictionally, like put them through these like really kind of arbitrary but silly kind of personality tests and stuff. And
right. That's a really good way to put it.
Yeah. I love, so how, like, what did you find? I love that you said you went for feeling more than for, you know, anything else when it came to characters. So when I'm thinking of certain characters from the book in my mind, like I know exactly what you're talking about, because there's some that have contrasting elements, but it's like they're tethered with humor, or you know what I mean? They're not so outlandishly contrasted, if that makes sense.
Yeah. And I've been told that it's a very humorous book too. And I never, that's something that always comes afterwards with me. Like, I never set out to even make something have like black humor to it. It's just,
right.
I'm always kind of shocked when someone says my work is funny, but I think something happens once, you know, when things become like, when the poetry ends and things just become so deliberate, it becomes mm-hmm. really humorous, you know, when the artifice of it just drops, the frankness of it can be really humorous.
Matter of factness of it. There is a very direct, almost journalistic quality to it, which, you know, knowing that you're pulling from your own experiences and stuff. And this is something I'm just personally like really investigating within my own stuff, is like how that formulation, like how that resolve kind of happens when you can let go of a memory being exact, or like, you know what I mean? You can let it breed into other things, or combining them into stuff. Cause it's, I don't know if you feel this, but as I get older, I almost feel like more, you know, hard-nosed about memory and the mm-hmm. past, you know, as like as a crutch almost.
mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, you mentioned the journalistic angle. A big inspiration mm-hmm. for this book, the very first book I read during the pandemic was The Executioner's Song by Norman Mailer.
Oh yeah,
about Gary Gilmore. It's like the 1,000-page epic about Gary Gilmore, and it's written in that really cold, almost like Truman Capote, like journalistic style. And I really wanted it to have that tone. When I did the rewrite, I kind of changed, you know, I changed that voice a little bit, but I think a lot of that still maybe remains in the book. So it's sort of a juxtaposition of,
There's an undercurrent like, there, but there's
sort
still
of a gonzo style and also kind of like a very cold, very cold journalistic style.
And I get like, that's maybe where the humor comes in, as you were saying. And it's also like, I find the humor because I'm sharing almost in, correlative memory in a way. And it's almost like an uncomfortable kind of humor, you know, it's like,
That's why you laugh, because you're nervous, you know, it's like a the best, if you're not laughing for pure joy, you're laughing because something's making you incredibly nervous and you don't know what else to do. So I could see a lot of those lines maybe inducing that nervousness.
Well, how has, you know, you left LA, or you left Southern California, you hit the desert, you're what, six or 7 years on now? And
I'm like almost a decade out here.
Decade. Yeah.
Yeah. It's crazy. Yeah. I have to remind myself how long it's been. It's,
really found your atmosphere there. Like there was a calling, you know, I'm feeling that too, of a getting out of the city sort of, you know, like, omnipresent kind of ick about, about this sort of thing.
Yeah. I mean, I couldn't imagine living in any city ever again, really. I mean, this is, it's not without its challenges out here, but yeah, I mean, I don't think there's any turning back. It's too, you become part of the landscape out here in ways that you intended and also were never prepared for. And it's, I love it out here. I mean, I say this all the time, but if I'm ever in a bad mood, I just walk outside of my house and I like instantly reminded where I am, and that, you know, that my problems are petty at best.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. There's a bit of man versus nature, like a kind of communion, you know, in that heat and in that arid atmosphere. But at the same time, it seems like, you know, was it Space Cowboy? Like, it seems like there's a lot of literary and musical communion down there too. Like, there's
definitely a yeah. It's we just had they just had the Twenty Nine Palms Book Festival, the second annual Twenty Nine Palms Book Festival, and that was like twice as big as last year, and that's been a real kind of boon to the literary scene. And yeah, Space Cowboy Books is still holding strong. It's all kinds of, I mean, it also it's changing so much up here too. I mean, it's changed so much in the last 10 years, for the better and a lot for the worse. It's interesting because there's so many people are moving out here, which I couldn't, you know, I knew that was going to happen, you know, but
yeah.
It's also such a transient place because it's a tourist, it's a high area of high tourism. So there's this level of transience where you can't, it's kind of hard to get close to people because you don't know how long they're going to be around. You don't know what their intentions are even for being here.
Right.
There's a lot of like opportunists here that are trying to just like, make money up here and run, whether it's the whole Airbnb thing or just start. There's like, yeah, the thing about the desert too, there's an element of like the grifter up here. These people that just show up and you have to think like, why are they here? Like and you realize a lot of these people are grifters where they burned bridges from wherever else they were from and there's nowhere else they can go. They could have gone and so we end up here. So you really have to have your wits about you when you just meet people here because you don't know what their intentions are. I guess you could say the same thing as like meeting someone in the city, but it's different here.
For sure.
People are so, can be very, very obvious up here without realizing it, and also very, very deceiving as well.
How does that like inform? I mean, like, yeah, what is kind of a Morongo Valley day for you when it comes to, you know, you balancing, you know, the writing and the music? I'm not sure if outside of the Starvations, like kind of archival stuff, is there jail weddings on the horizon? Are you music out there?
Yeah, I've been going back to LA this year, like not as much as I'd like to, but yeah, we're like working on a new record and
awesome.
It's kind of just me and the boys right now.
Okay.
Just trying to flesh out the songs. And I think we're going to call on everyone else when the time is right, just not to waste everyone's time. But yeah, that's going slower than I would like it to, but I think writing has just become so much a part of my life. I mean, I'm writing literally all day, whether I'm doing radio stuff or fiction or you know, other projects. So I've definitely turned into more of like my priorities have changed a little bit. Writing's just more of an immediate thing I can just do without even thinking. And music takes major effort, I think, and it's tough.
And other people to some degree, you know. I'm with you. There's I definitely feel like I'm getting into the season where like I don't know if you've seen these Alpha Smart Neos. They're like,
no, I have no idea what that is.
They're from 2000, like the early 2000s, and it's basically just a word processor. It's like this.
Oh, I think I saw. I think I saw you post a photo.
Yeah, yeah. And like that's been to me, that's been my reprieve. That, you know, I slap it in a bag. My phone's not coming out. Like anywhere I go, it just writing just seems to be like the end all be all of just pure, you know, I don't know, like creation really without a lot of tools. That of course is like a tool, but. Just meaning that, you know, yeah, I definitely feel that more of like an era instead of a season, you know, of just you know, that kind of hushed self-reliance about, you know, creating, not needing much to do so, you know?
Yeah, exactly. But yeah, I mean, there was a while during the pandemic where I was even like really bitter towards music and just like, you know, all these social upheavals were happening during 2020. And I'm just like, God, I just want to watch the whole music industry just burn to the ground too. Like, you know, it just seemed like ripe and ready for that to happen, as corrupt as it's always been. And I think I was just burnt out too. And I think it was tough watching the world burn and to think, you know, and to even consider being like a white guy strutting around on a stage again. You know, it just seemed totally, all of a sudden, completely just trite. So I think, I've had a huge crisis of faith with the whole thing, but I also just don't, you know, I think it's sort of silly to throw out the baby with the bathwater. I think singing is really important to me, and I think it's really, you know, singing makes me feel better. I think it's something, I think the vibrations that happen when someone sings, when you allow yourself to sing, it could be just a really healing and a very necessary thing to do. So I realize I shouldn't, you know, let go of that part of me either.
Well, yeah, that's good to hear, but I totally understand where you're coming from. And especially that needing that kind of somatic exorcism of singing and, you know, even playing something rhythmically, there's just something to it that's uncanny, you know?
Mm-hmm.
But I wanted to talk about Beyond the Last Estate, which I don't have with me in the room, but I'm a proud owner of the first issue and really excited about it too.
Thank you again for copying one too. I appreciate it.
Of course. Yeah. I love it. I feel like, you know, kind of to tether it to the 2020-isms of just kind of the death of how things are delivered media-wise, you know, and it's not regression, but it's almost, it's more of like a dance with the things that we loved and like what made us excited about writing or music. And it's always going to be like these print, you know, things. And I love that you're editing this magazine basically. And there's what would you call it? A rag, obviously, but it's like the magazine size and the format, but it's, it's awesome. Lots of beautiful writing. Cool.
What's up?
I was just going to ask, what was the, you know, the creation myth on that one?
So Beyond the Last Estate, there was a website called The Last Estate that me and a collective group of friends and I started in 2021. Mm-hmm. 2021, and it lasted from 2021 to 2023. There's a bunch of my writer friends that kind of grew out of this Friday night writing group called Misery Loves Company that came from this website called Misery Tourism. And William and Rudy, who run Misery Loves Company, just got called on me and my friend Derek Main and Jesse Hilson and maybe like four or five other people, sort of a revolving cast, to start this website of what we were calling creative reporting on literature and the arts. And the guise of the website is that we all live together in this dilapidated southern plantation mansion, mm-hmm. this kind of post-apocalyptic thing, and it was all of us living together reporting on the corpse of culture, I guess, was what we were saying. So it was a really fruitful time, and lasted for a couple of years, and I think, you know, all good things have to end, and it was the perfect time to end it. And we were just like, what's next? And I just kept like Rudy, his aesthetic was just so beautiful. And, you know, lots of neon and lots of like ghosts and secret passages in this mansion he created. And I was just like, God, it would be so cool to make a coffee table book out of this. And then I'm all like, no, that'd be too expensive. And then I couldn't stop thinking about like, there needs to be, you know, this whole literature, indie literature scene is so online based and it seems so disposable. There needs to be like a print headquarters for all this stuff to kind of help. I don't want to say like legitimize it, but something to look forward to, and maybe something to just get people's eyes off the screen.
Absolutely.
I was working for Lit Reactor. I was contributing to them every month, and they folded. And I was like, God, I really miss, you know, writing about writing and, you know, interviewing authors. And it became so much a part of me. And not only was I bummed to see Lit Reactor go, which was, they were such an institution to so many people, but I just missed the act of writing about writing and writing about writers. Book reviews, all that stuff. So I used the death of that venue is like, okay, something else just needs to happen, and if no one else isn't going to do it, I'm just going to do something. So taught myself InDesign, and really challenging, but yeah, now it's like kind of a piece of cake. And I have a whole slew of contributors, and everyone's getting along really well and delivering really, really amazing stuff. And I couldn't be happier.
No, that's awesome. Yeah, I love it. It's definitely something that I just felt very synchronous to, like what we were doing kind of in our collective that was an online blog thing that was in person, and then pandemic happened and became this online kind of free for all, and the emptiness that we were kind of left with, you know, after that of, yeah, it, a lot of it does. And I don't mean to sound like, you know, Steve Albini about it, but, or like, you know, super analog nerd, you know, about it, but like, there is just a tactile kind of, just print, you know. I think it's in my family too. My grandparents owned a ribbon business and would do like small press, you know, printing, hot press and old Ludlow machines. And yeah, it's just something there that I just feel like anytime I release an album or, you know, I post an article somewhere, it just feels like it just vanishes into this like amorphous digital ether. And, you know, with blue light.
I totally agree. There's a huge misconception that the internet is forever. It's totally not. There's like so many great pieces of writing that have just disappeared from the internet and with no accountability. And like, print isn't the most cost effective option, but it is, you know, it is forever as long as like your house doesn't burn down, you know?
Right. And there's a sense of ownership about that too, of how you take care of something, you know, that you procure. And like, yeah, I love that. I love this, all these like unspoken, like, communions with the different aspects of that, of mailing it, of, you know, packaging it, of receiving it, of reading it, of earmarking it, you know. It's just, it's sad that, you know, that needs to be addressed, or maybe not sad, but I do catch myself being a little pompous about it, or like silly about, you know, how kind of unremarkable it is. But it's like really remarkable to me, just because it's been so missing, or people haven't really put it in the, you know, the forefront, like, you know, I think we used to. And so, and I love Misery Tourism. I've seen a couple of their, like, writer shares on YouTube, and or Misery Loves Company. And yeah, it was just it's just great. I'm just happy that there's like places of anarchic weirdos making cool shit, you know.
Yeah, no, agreed. And the thing the thing too about print, I mean, my biggest concern, and I know a lot of people share this point of view too, the thing with like internet writing is like, it's cool, yeah, because it's so immediate, and you know, you'll often get work accepted that'll end up on a site, you know, the next day or the next week, but rarely is that stuff edited by, you know,
oh yeah,
by the people on the masthead of those online journals. And it's like everyone is so impatient for self-validation and stuff, and they're just so, you know, they just want that dopamine hit of like their work being out there. And yeah, so when something is in print, like whether it's your book or, you know, I think print magazines are important because people are hopefully actually editing the work that you're,
yeah,
that's you're something reading. I think there's something a little more intimidating and glaring when you see mistakes or imperfections in something, you know, that's laid out in something that people are going to be holding in their hands, you know, that seem a little more permanent, you know?
Yeah, for sure. I mean,
there's a lot more care I've seen with contributors giving me work for Beyond the Last Estate than I think, you know, than it would have been if it was like an online journal.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah.
And there's like a, you know, mm-hmm. they're a lot more open to me actually helping edit their work and stuff. So.
Well, that's brilliant because, yeah, I think, you know, and we kind of learned self-publishing as a collective, and it's one thing to have the tit for tat. Like, I think this looks good, especially for people that wear a bunch of hats, like in that setting, but it's another to have a, you know, the focused mind of editing and really like correlating to how this is going to flow with everything. And I think that's like where we got spoiled, I think, with online things. And I'm finding with our like moving to print is that we almost in a kind of like anarchic way, or like, no, keep the typos in, like, fuck them, like, you know what I mean, like everything's pristine now, there's no you know, there's no Grammarly with this, you know, like that. And it can go so much the opposite way that it ruins the kind of, you know, flow. So we're finding our footing and just taking more consideration. Like it really does come down to intent, you know. And
yeah, definitely. Yeah, you don't want to sell yourself short. Like if you're so into like producing, you know, work, why would you? Yeah, people just need to slow down, I think. I think that's the biggest. There's this big pressure on being prolific because, you know, and it's like the chicken or the egg. It's like, are people being, like, what happened first? Like, people's low attention spans or people feeling the need to be super prolific to cater to the short attention spans, you know? It's
absolutely.
Yeah. We have to just completely, I think, pull back.
Yeah, I'm with you. It's a hard thing to unlearn, too. I think, you know, it's a spoil culture of sorts, of especially when it's about kind of a validation of how many eyes, you know, get to see this thing, or how many people you're reaching. Like I went through, I don't know how you feel about, I mean, just kind of streaming at large, but like I took down, you know, I took off a bunch of my albums from streaming a year ago, and I've just kind of piecemealed, like tested maybe a song here or there or whatever, just to let it languish in kind of a, you know, goodbye mode. And I feel that's like, that's just kind of where we at with the internet. It almost makes more sense to be deeply intentful and like tactile with what you're creating and find the right people. I mean, you know.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, and again, I, my, I'm so grateful for Dave Clifford for doing these reissues, because I would have done that on my own, because I don't give it, I don't have Spotify or anything like that. I mean, you know, fine, if people use Spotify, it's great that those songs are going to be on there, but I wouldn't have given a shit otherwise. So
yeah,
great. Sure. Someone's doing that. Yeah. I'm not like a Steve Albini guy either. I'm not like a super, you know, analog
purist
either, but I'm like, I rarely listen to digital music. It just doesn't even occur to me. I'm not anti-digital music. It's not even like an instinct of mine.
Yeah. No, that makes perfect sense. So you went on a book tour a little bit after Red Tide came out. How did that go? It sounded like it was awesome.
It was really, yeah, it was really great. It was, you know, these things are always such a gamble. You know, mm-hmm. you buy a plane ticket and fly across the country, you know, for some readings, and you know, it's almost presumptuous in a way, like thinking that anyone's going to show up, but it was, no, it was really great that, you know, Pig Roast, Jeff from Pig Roast met me in Brooklyn, and he had set up these readings for us. He set up a reading in Manhattan for us at the KGB bar, which was very well-established old literary bar. It's been there for decades. New York is very, it's funny. I was there in 2021 for a reading, and I feel like New York is, yeah, it was like the first time New York was really making sense to me. And the first time I really realized, like, wow, this city, as big as it is, it's very supportive of this kind of thing.
Hmm.
And yeah, I mean, it was great. Like at 7 o'clock, the bar was packed with people, and it couldn't have been a better reception. The readers were great. I got to meet Danielle Chelosky, who's become a great friend since the reading, and we sold a fair amount of books and stuff, but that these things aren't really actually about selling books. It's about, you know, it's actually about meeting people. It's about testing the relationships of these people you previously only knew from the internet, you know?
Sure. Yeah.
And tempering these relationships to make sure that they're real, you know?
Yeah.
And yeah, so for that, it was really reassuring, and it felt like, yeah, there was a lot of camaraderie. And after, yeah, the next day me and Jeff and Cletus Crow, this really great poet on Pig Roast, and then another great poet, Morgan Reed, drove down to Philadelphia, and we read at this place called Tattooed Mom, this kind of punk bar, multi-level punk bar. And yeah, it was like 5 days of just really great revelry, and yeah, couldn't have asked for a better trip.
I loved, you invited me back at, what was it, Mother Foucault's in like 2018?
Oh yeah. Yeah. That was great.
And like, there's something that stays with me still about just reading, that kind of vulnerability. I was nervous as all hell because I didn't have anything to hide behind. You know, I didn't have guitar or, you know, whatever instruments or, you know.
Oh yeah. Was that your first time reading?
Yeah.
Oh yeah. It's terrifying the first time you do it, like for those exact reasons.
It starts
finding typos in your, you know, your,
yep.
I think a writer should always read their stuff out loud.
Yeah.
In the editing process, because that's just huge. I mean, you get all senses that way.
I agree. But yeah, that was like the first public, and it haunts me because I felt really, there was a fulfillment I had was not getting from music or performing, you know, mm-hmm. around that time.
You were great. I would have. Yeah. I remember you being near perfect.
Oh, thanks. I remember Mary telling me about a twitch I had where I was like kind of clasping my arm, you know, those little things of.
Oh yeah. We all have our one, you know, major tick.
Yeah, but yeah, I think the live reading too is just something I don't know. I feel kind of at sea out here in this large city, but that sort of community-based, you know, thing of getting back to reading prose, you know, in public or at bars or cafes or bookstores. It's like, yeah, it just, it was something really fulfilling when I did it. So thank you for inviting me to do that back when. And it's something that I've had in the back of my mind is I want to keep trying or like keep pursuing that, you know?
Yeah, no, I think it's really important. Yeah. Just the immediacy and, you know, to take it to another level, like, you know, hopefully, you know, so it's not a bunch of people just like reciting their work and like poet voices and stuff, which is
sure.
Can be really a bit much, you know, we should treat it like a performance and, you know, their sense of, you know, breathy urgency maybe, you know, mm-hmm. Or else why else would you care?
Absolutely. So what's on the docket? I know you've got another Beyond the Last Estate issue coming out. Oh, your radio show, which I wanted to hear more about if you have a little time. Just you're kind of like on air reporting, yeah?
Yeah, and it's not a radio show. I'm a news reporter. It's, yeah.
Oh, like okay. Oh, damn.
My beat is the Morongo Valley. Yeah, I mean, what's great about Z1077, it's they've been non-corporate, I think, since 87. But it's feel, you know, you go in there and it's like this bustling old school radio environment.
Bullpen. And I just couldn't,
what's up?
Bullpen and like, yeah.
Yeah. Really that's awesome. high energy, but no bullshit, you know, it's like,
mm-hmm.
It feels kind of familial and, yeah, kind of a throw. It feels like there's like a bit of a pipeline to the past.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's yeah. Yeah, I'm really grateful for it though. They let me kind of pitch whatever I want. I mean, I'll do stuff from like school meetings to like a little bit of crime to like,
mm-hmm.
Yeah, a lot of like literary stuff. I'm usually like the guy that will report on like literary stuff happening in town or, you know, visiting authors and stuff like that. So yeah, I have a pretty, pretty wide scope.
That's amazing. Talk about community oriented too. That's yeah. Lovely.
And it doesn't, you know, it's hard work we all do there, but it doesn't feel like work because it's writing. Right. It's like,
it's service. Yeah.
I'd be doing it anyway at home, you know?
Nice. Yeah. Well, I know you said you were working on some new Jail Weddings. It'll come when it comes. But, yeah, what's 2025 shaping up for you like?
I really want to revisit this other novel manuscript I had. I started writing a novel when I moved out here, and it's just been this thing that's gnawing at me. It's sort of like a desert noir, but also like a domestic kind of dystopian. God, what would you call it? Yeah, it's like Revolutionary Road.
Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf?
Yeah, oh, totally. Yeah, you know what I'm talking about.
Yeah, yeah. That's awesome.
Yeah, but yeah, again, I haven't looked at my dear friend who was beta reading it passed away 2 years ago, and I'm just like it's just haunting me to like even open that document again because it just makes me sad because she was like the last one to be looking at it. So I need to just kind of get get over myself and just realize that it's just a piece of writing and get back into it. So yeah, I think that'll be something I'll be focusing on next year. And then yeah, I have a short story.
You're not very deadline like heavy. You're kind of
nah.
You're gonna just work on it until it's ready, all right?
Yeah, I don't know why people do that to themselves. Deadlines, yeah. Like, why? What is the rush? Like, why do people? I mean, we're not getting paid for this. Why would you put a deadline? Right. For, you know, who are you trying? Who are you trying to be on time for? You know.
Yeah, you don't know how much I needed to hear that. Actually,
it's good to set goals. You know, if we didn't set goals, sure, we would just be spinning our wheels our whole lives. But deadlines? Are you kidding me? Like, get out of here.
Yeah. Save that for the newsroom.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, thanks so much, man. Is there anything else you wanted to mention or any kind of, you know, I'll get all of your pertinent links and all that stuff sorted and whatnot, but just want to give you some time for the floor if you had anything that you wanted to blast out.
You can get my novel On High Red Tide from pigrosepublishing.com. We prefer that you order straight from the publisher for obvious reasons. You can order Beyond the Last Estate, issue 2 with David Kunlein on the cover. Is it Kunlein? God, I hope I didn't butcher his name. You contact beyondthelastestate@gmail.com and I will give you the ordering information. I mean, that's about it. I'm around.
So Beyond the Last Estate, do you take submissions at all, or are you?
I don't want it to turn into like a slush pile situation. I take pitches. I encourage people to write to that email address and pitch me stuff. I could only take like 5 to 6 long form contributors an issue, and that tends to fill up kind of quick, but I'm always taking as many 100-word book reviews as people can dish out. That's turned into a really actually like potent format that, you know, people seem to be really stoked on, and it's garnering a lot of interest for these books, and ends up being a quick way to get the word out. And I don't, with these small reviews, I don't like them to be synopsis of the book. I want them to be like a poetic exchange. Sure. You know, I want these reviews to be like little jewels in themselves, you know.
Yeah.
Interpretive, you know.
I love it. Yeah, it's a great work. It's awesome. You're hitting not only, you know, the long form narrative novel, the solo work, but the communal work with Beyond the Last Estate, and, you know, of course, all the music and everything. And hey, man, congratulations. I'll just say that, you know.
Thank you. I really appreciate that.
Wonderful totemic artifacts that we are creating across many a medium, from our collective Be the Hallowed to me personally. One major talismanic journal is my publication of the Divergent Magical Grimoire. Anyone can use it. It is magician operational. It is paradigm operational. There is no distinct current. It is a schema for you to log, create, construct, deconstruct, hell, even ruin the rituals that make your art, that make your day, that make your communion to the other. So you can check this out, as well as t-shirts and fun ephemera from We the Hollowed artist Eric J. Millar, or me, like Dakota Slim, Rebel Ross, who I just released a new song sigil that I'll be releasing every few weeks or so. That is also accompanied with a Videomantic visualizer, and that'll all build into the debut first highly produced full-length album. Here you know about the Pragmagic podcast or the YouTube channel, and I really, really appreciate you stopping by, giving us some tricky old demonic engagement in these digital rhythms. But a like, a share, a subscribe, all of that tit-for-tat kind of clickety-clack really goes a long way to help support a bunch of magical ephemera of all sorts. So help support the DIY human error punks in fighting this ridiculous, absurd, new high-tech era with some high-touch magics. Thanks for stopping by. Patreon.com/PrideMagic.